Thanks, Julie, and hi, everyone. There's a kind of handout going around, just some passages from Marx. I didn't expect the meeting to be this size, and there are not enough to go around. And I also apologize for the fact that about two-thirds of the copies of this handout are in very, very tiny print. And if you're able to read it, you're a better sighted person than I am. But I apologize for not anticipating the interest in this topic. So I want to begin by asking a couple of what seemed to me pretty obvious questions for this start at this meeting. Why is the issue of human nature important? Why does it matter in today's political environment, this question about human nature? Now, one way to respond to these questions would be to focus on pretty familiar right-wing attacks on socialism as completely incompatible with such basic aspects of human nature as self-interest and individual freedom. In a Cato Institute policy report published a few years ago, but what it said is so characteristic that I'm going to use it here at the beginning. Anyway, that Cato Institute report declared that Marx's theory of human nature is a biological fantasy. Communism is deadly because it is contrary to human nature. Capitalism alone, this report declared, is based on the realities of self-assertion, self-assertiveness, and competitiveness, as recent work in evolutionary psychology demonstrates. And you can find more recent versions of this position on the websites of the Heritage Foundation, the National Review, and other right-wing organizations. But more important for our discussion today, I think, are views on the left that also, I would say, imply sometimes some kinds of incompatibility between socialism and human nature, and emphasize a kind of inescapable acceptance that at least some features of capitalism reflect inherent, unavoidable human needs and drives, and that it's a kind of daydream to pretend otherwise. Back in May of 2014, in an article in The Nation called Growing Inequality, can you hear me okay now? Let me know if you can. Okay. So back in May 2014, in a piece in The Nation called Growing Inequality by Obama's first Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, Reich began the article this way: some inequality of income and wealth is inevitable, if not necessary. If an economy is to function well, people need incentives to work hard and innovate. Reich's assumption here is that hard work and innovation are rooted in an innate human desire to possess more wealth than others, and thus to exert control and dominance over others. And you can hear such views as these days, at least by implication, in pronouncements by Democratic presidential hopefuls such as Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker. Fortunately, you can also hear boos from the audience when Democrats like John Hickenlooper, in a speech at the California Democratic Convention at the beginning of June, insisted that socialism is not the answer. There is, incidentally, a piece on the New Yorker website, if you ever look at that, from just a few days ago, called John Hickenlooper's War on Socialism. I didn't learn a whole lot from this piece, but I mentioned it because it's out there and you may want to check it out. For those of us at this conference, I'm arguing, the most important situation to focus on comes up when we're talking with people who are disgusted by inequality and exploitation, who may be open to radical organization and activity in response to conditions in Trump's America, but who are held back to some degree by a belief that the principles and goals of socialism, however admirable or desirable, are just not sufficiently in touch with human beings' basic self-centeredness, aggression, or even acceptance of the status quo. many people who get interested in socialism because of the inequality and exploitation of capitalist society believe that the existing system can be reformed, but that the revolutionary project of actually getting rid of capitalism and replacing it with a system based on addressing human need through workers' democratic control of economic production and distribution is a utopian dream at odds with human nature. It's views like this that I especially want to engage in this discussion today. And I want to begin by doing this by looking at Karl Marx's basic position on the question of human nature. Marx says that the ideas of the ruling class are, in every epoch, the ideas, in every epoch, the ruling ideas. Just quote that again since I muffed it. The ideas of the ruling class are, in every epoch, the ruling ideas. For the past several hundred years, what most people have taken to be the defining features of human nature are actually ideological tenets of the capitalist ruling order. In contrast to today's postmodernist and post-structuralist, Marx believed that there is such a thing as human nature. For him, the term referred to the distinguishing characteristics, including ways of acting, thinking, feeling, that human beings share as a species. And Marx's writing, particularly his early writing, which you have some examples of on this handout, used the term species being in connection with this part of what he had to say. Early in his life as an activist and a writer, he set out to develop a critical alternative to the capitalist ideology of human nature. And he begins by challenging two widely held beliefs. First, the belief that human nature is directly and fully reflected by the way things are now in capitalist culture, with its social inequality, competitiveness, and exploitation. Secondly, Marx challenges the assumption that human nature is fixed and unchanging, that humans are now the way they've always essentially been, and that capitalist culture is the fullest representation of this basically fixed underlying nature. In opposition to these assumptions, Marx develops four main lines of argument. One, Marx argues that human beings are, of course, mammals, and therefore in their bodily lives, part of nature. But their consciousness of their own life activity distinguishes them from all other animals. Second, human beings are inherently social and in distinctive ways. Their consciousness of their own life activity becomes a collective consciousness of human beings as a species. And the interaction between individual human experience or identity and the social or collective sense of humanity is as you could, I hope, hear in this second point, very pivotal for Marx's position on this. Three, human beings produce their own means of subsistence through their labor, and they do this in specific ways at specific times in history. And then fourth, in laboring in and on the material world to transform it to meet their needs, human beings change themselves. For Marx, human nature is distinctively flexible and changeable. Human labor is not just conscious in a distinctive way that's distinctive to humans. It is that, but human labor can also be imaginative and transformative. And I'm going to read a few sentences from the first passage on the handout. Now, these initial passages are all taken from Marx's very early work that were collected together in his economic and philosophical manuscripts, but just to get a sense of his vocabulary, and also his preoccupation with this kind of problem or issue of human nature early in his career as a writer. Man is a species being, and I'll just pause after that first clause to say, The standard English translations of Marx make him sound sexist in a way that I think is misleading. The word that Marx always uses, or almost always uses, in these positions where the conventional English translation has man, is the German word Mensch. And Mensch in German doesn't just mean men, it means men and women of both genders. And I just think it's worth pointing that out. I'll use the term man here because I can't translate quickly enough or modify quickly enough, but I don't like to let these passages that begin man as a species being to go past without asking you to think about that. So man is a species being not only because in practice and in theory he adopts the species, his own as well as those of other things, as his object, but, and this is only another way of expressing it, also because he treats himself as the actual living species, because he treats himself as a universal and therefore a free being. The life of the species, both in man and in animals, consists physically in the fact that man, like the animal, lives on organizing nature. That man's physical and spiritual life is linked to nature means simply that nature is linked to itself, for man is a part of nature. However, he goes on, the animal is immediately one with its life activity. It does not distinguish itself from it. It is its life activity. Man makes his life activity itself the object of his will and of his consciousness. He has conscious life activity. And this distinctive kind of consciousness is really important to what Marx has to say more broadly on the question of human nature. So Paul Blackledge, a British Marxist, wrote in a good article back in 2007, very interestingly on this point, I'll just quote briefly from that piece. Marx was interested in how we remake ourselves through work and how the future potentialities of humanity emerge from this remaking of our nature. The remaking of our nature is constrained by the specific material conditions humanity confronts at specific historical moments. It is not, then, absolute in its self-determination. Instead, the remaking of our nature emerges as a dialectic between changing human self-awareness and agency and particular objective conditions and circumstances. That's the basic Marxist position. It gets elaborated in somewhat different terms in the middle and later part of Marx's life. But this, I think, needs to be the kind of founding point for discussion. It's important to acknowledge that within Marxism itself, there have been debates around this question of human nature. Because Marx believed that human nature is determined by human interaction with the material world, and that it changed in the course of history as material conditions and social relations changed, some on the left have claimed that Marx eventually came to believe that there was no such thing as human nature. This view is mistaken, I think. It's based on too narrow, rigid, and undialectical a reading of what Marx wrote. As Norman Garros pointed out in his 1983 book, Marx and Human Nature: Refutation of a Legend, the belief that Marx's historical materialism applied a rejection of the concept of a universal human nature is actually an old Stalinist fixation, the term Garros uses, that was given new life of a certain kind for a time by the French structuralist Marxist Louis Althusser. And I may have something to say, particularly depending on how the conversation goes later on, about Althusser's comments on Marx and human nature. The right perspective, though, I think, is the one summarized by Elizabeth Terzakis in a 2006 article in the International Socialist Review. Terzakis writes there, from a socialist perspective, there is such a thing as human nature, but its most prominent feature is its changeability. What makes us distinctly human is our ability not only to change as our circumstances change, but to create new and different social relations and then adapt to them. Socialists argue that if humans could create capitalism, humans can create socialism. This last sentence takes us provocatively to the core of Marxist historical materialism and poses crucial and, I believe, still very relevant questions about whether the development from capitalism to socialism can happen gradually, or has to happen gradually, and can happen only through reform, or requires instead, ultimately, a revolution. I want to turn now to disagreements between Marx's ideas about human nature and some recent developments in evolutionary and genetic science, and also in the style of thinking we often refer to as postmodernism. In 1849, Marx moved to London and spent the rest of his life there and immersed himself in British intellectual culture. He responded enthusiastically to Darwin's theory of evolution as set out in On the Origin of Human Species, published in 1859, the same year as Marx's groundbreaking contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. Marx read Darwin in 1860 and wrote to Engels, quote, "This is the book which contains the basis in natural history for our own views." Marx saw that Darwin's work supported a fundamentally materialist approach to the development of the human species and of human society by demonstrating that historical change was an essential principle in the development of all life. Marx also realized, however, that Darwin's account of biological evolution through natural selection, though compatible with historical materialism's understanding of the development of human society, was not identical to it. This realization is critical in assessing some of the recent claims from scientific fields such as sociobiology and evolutionary psychology in relation to Marx's position on human nature. Now, in what follows, I'm going to be drawing on three really valuable articles published in International Socialist Review by Phil Gasper. One called Is Biology Destiny, in volume 38, 2004. Another called Genes, Evolution, and Human Nature, published in volume 41, 2005. And a third called Darwin's Dangerous Ideas, volume 54, 2007. All those by Phil Gasper. The basic perspective of much sociobiology, as Gasper points out, is that our biological inheritance determines human behavior in society to a very extensive, if not kind of total degree. Recent advances in genetic research especially have led to claims by sociobiologists, for example, that certain kinds of violent crime, or even marital infidelity, if you can believe it, are functions of genetic difference. As for evolutionary psychology, proponents of this discipline, such as Harvard biologist and theorist E.O. Wilson, postulate that there are actually particular genes for behaviors such as entrepreneurship, creativity, xenophobia, and male domination, that those kinds of social and political behavior are genetically encoded. Evolutionary psychologists deny or downplay the role of social formations and cultural differences. A New York Times article published some years ago, but I keep it around because I still can hardly believe the argument it makes, but you need to know there are people out there still taking ideas like this seriously. The article's called The Biology of Risk, and it argued that the so-called risk response is genetically encoded in human beings and therefore essential to capitalism and shouldn't be managed or controlled. The article shows absolutely no interest, it shows absolutely no interest in the difference between what risk might mean to a boss or a funds manager and what it might mean to a worker or a student. At best, such claims are grossly exaggerated and simplifying. They involve taking important scientific advances and applying them in broad, speculative, unprovable ways. at their worst, sociobiology and evolutionary psychology merge sometimes with despicable kinds of right-wing ideologies and practices like the eugenics movement of the late 19th and early 20th century, as well as with more recent race-based theories of crime, warfare, and other forms of social violence. Sociobiology and evolutionary psychology are hostile to Marxism and socialism, and this isn't surprising. Marxism embraces serious experimental science, but it insists that what evolutionary science reveals is the development of a human brain distinctively capable of self-reflective, critical, flexible, creative potential as human beings respond socially and collectively to their material conditions. If the problem with sociobiology and evolutionary psychology is a reductive, undialectical determinism, the problem with postmodernism is the mirror opposite, a limiting and politically paralyzing kind of relativism. Now, the term postmodernism is a broad catch-all in some ways, and I just want to say that I'm not here referring mainly or really at all to forms of artistic work or literary production that come under the or characterize themselves or adhere to postmodernism. I'm really talking about postmodernist theory, and particularly that version of postmodernist theory that goes under the terms post-structuralism or deconstruction. It's their limiting and politically paralyzing relativism that I want to focus our attention on. Instead of simplifying and exaggerating the importance of the physical sciences, postmodernism tends to minimize or ignore science by characterizing it as naively positivist, that is, naively reliant and exclusively reliant on the logical and mathematical processing of sense data. Postmodernism is also aggressively and avowedly and sometimes polemically anti-humanist. It denies that human nature or human identity mean anything other than constructs or fictions produced by and within language or discourse, as they prefer to say, the postmodernists, in which there's nothing but difference and indeterminacy. While this kind of view has sometimes been used to deconstruct dominant mainstream ideologies of human identity, for example, heteronormative sexuality, postmodernism provides no positive alternative to such ideologies and no affirmative understanding of collective human self-determination and solidarity. Postmodernism offers instead a fashionable, usually cool skepticism and a fetishizing of indeterminacy that really gets in the way, I believe, of thinking as a political activist through these kinds of questions and engaging with them in ways that don't just give in to the political passivity and defeatism that I think postmodernism tends to encourage. Socialists should respond to postmodernist anti-humanism by readily acknowledging that Marx was a humanist, a critical, materialist, revolutionary humanist, and that as socialists, we want to be that kind of humanist too. I don't think we should ever back away from that term, and especially from the Marxist tradition of humanist analysis and activism. The political tradition we call Marxism combines a relentless critique of ruling class beliefs about human nature with an affirmation of the distinctive and universal human potential for social transformation. With its emphasis on human labor as inherently social and as always simultaneously both physical and mental, Marxism foregrounds practical consciousness, conscious activity, in its imaginative transformative potential. And even in Trump world, we get glimpses of such human potential, not only from the distant past, in evidence, for instance, of hunter-gatherer societies that prioritize shared labor, cooperation, and peaceful solidarity over aggressive competition, but from today's experience right before us in our own unequal exploitative society. We see such responses that Marx himself pointed to as intrinsic to human potential. In the aftermath of disasters like Hurricane Katrina, for instance, or the Boston Marathon bombing, or the recent wildfires in California, or an organized workers' resistance like the teacher strikes and the hotel worker strikes, when ordinary people reach out in acts of spontaneous solidarity to help and support each other. Marx saw human identity as the historical collective struggle for self-determination and self-realization. He understood, too, that the social dimension of this struggle inevitably must be and will become international and global, that it's not a struggle distinctive for very long to any one sector of the global society. In the course of their evolution, human beings have developed a distinctive, though not absolute, power to shape their own existence, to change their relation to material conditions, as Marx put it, to make their own history. We have the capacity to see and act on the realization that our own human nature is not merely a reflection of the way things are now under capitalism, and that the way things are now doesn't represent in any sense the limits of humanity's potential to create a society, as Marx says in the Communist Manifesto, in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. This is a political vision of human potential that those of us on the left, as well as our adversaries on the right, need to be freshly challenged by. Thanks.